Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Charles L. Chavis Jr. about his new book, The Silent Shore, The Lynching of Matthew Williams and the Politics of Racism in the Free State. Dr. Charles Chavis, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. So, Dr. Chavis, I wonder if you could just begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a historian who also practices peace building and racial justice in Fairfax, Virginia. I'm a professor at George Mason University, and I'm also a vice chair for the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so a lot of my work focuses not only on history, but connecting history to the present as we seek racial justice.
Wonderful. Great. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about this book. I wonder if you could talk a bit about your experiences researching this book and what brought you to this topic.
Sure. So my research began in a similar position that you're in as a doctoral student, a PhD student, early on as a doctoral student in the history department at Morgan State University. I began to wonder about the history of racial violence, specifically racial terror lynchings in Maryland, originally from North Carolina, a little further south. And I always was intrigued by the hyper-emphasis that was placed on states such as Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, et cetera, pertaining to racial terror lynchings. And I wonder what the legacy of racial terror was in the upper South, specifically in Baltimore and in border states such as Maryland. And so with that, I began researching the last documented cases of racial terror lynching in Maryland. And this ironically was right around the time of the Freddie Gray incidents that were taking place in Baltimore. And while I was doing this doctoral work and research, I was also working as a museum educator in Baltimore City, working with sixth graders at the Lily Carroll Jackson Middle School. And the museum that I worked at was the Lily Carroll Jackson Civil Rights Museum, named after a freedom fighter and civil rights activist from the 1930s, who was the NAACP president for the Baltimore City chapter. She was an anti-lynching advocate, and it was an anti-lynching museum. And I was arrested while being bombarded daily with the working with the students, and constantly they would look at the replica of the A Man Was Lynched Yesterday flag that hangs from that museum, and they would reflect on their current experience witnessing the death of Freddie Gray being discussed throughout their communities. And they asked me and the director, Dr. Iris Barnes, was Freddie Gray lynched, right? This really is important to understand in terms of the context out of which the research that I was doing was taking place. I sought out to dispel this myth that lynching somehow ended in the 1930s or has a specific deadline. And I sought out to salvage the humanity of one of the last two victims of racial terror lynching in Maryland, that of Matthew Williams in 1931.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I wonder if we could just get into sort of Matthew Williams. So could you explain the circumstances that are surrounding his lynching and how the communities, both white and black, responded to the event?
Sure. In order to understand the case of Matthew Williams, we have to understand what was going on in the country at the time. And so the case of Matthew Williams took place, the lynching of Matthew Williams took place in 1931, during right at the beginning of the Great Depression. If we zoom out a little bit outside of Maryland, we recognize that there is a pattern that is emerging during this interwar era, specifically at the beginning of the Great Depression. The assault on black laborers throughout the country is taking place. And ironically, during the same time, same year that Matthew Williams is lynched, you have just in Alabama, the Scottsboro Boys, who are dealing with potential murder charges for these alleged crimes. Again, black laborers who are directly targeted during this era and this period. Matthew Williams, a little further north in Maryland, is also caught up in this alleged assault and this victimization associated with black laborers that we see taking place throughout the country at this time. And it was very interesting when I soon discovered that the same organizations representing the Scottsboro Boys were representing black laborers on Maryland's Eastern Shore who were being targeted for this violence, alleged violence that they were committing onto their employers, right? And so there was a number of cases, not just Matthew Williams, that are directly tied to, again, this national movement that we see emerging directed towards attacking black laborers. And one of the things that I learned from Professor Sherlyn Ifill is that you don't get a pass for not finishing the job, right? And so a lot of people don't focus on the ways in which the psychological and physical violence of lynchings and racial terror are not always directly connected to the completion of the specific act, right? Lynchings, as I'll probably say more than once, they were message crimes, and they put communities, both communities, on notice and reinforce the racial hierarchy in ways that law enforcement and other bodies of government were not able to do so. And so Matthew Williams is the victim of racial terror, white racist and racial terror during this period. However, in doing the research, I discovered that there were a number of near lynchings that took place leading up to his case, which really served as fuel for the angered poor whites in this region, poor whites in this region, who were looking for a black, vulnerable black male to pay the price for those who had gotten off. And that's one of the things that's also important to understand as well. The very fact that lynchings are, racial terror lynchings are understood as extra legal, outside of the bounds of the law. And so you had a number of, one of the things that really angered these white members of the white community was the fact that at this point you had, both through the NAACP and through organizations such as the International Labor Defense, you had blacks who were now gaining representation, and they were somehow getting their days in court. And this angered white communities, and it really caused them to push to really, they caused a resurgence of racial terror lynchings that emerged because the law was moving too slow. And as a result, lynchings were being committed. And this was definitely the case with the case of Matthew Williams, who allegedly, to get to your question, answer your question the long way, he was, again, he got in a dispute with his employer over discrepancies in his pay. Allegedly he shot his employer and then shot himself, somehow ended up in the hospital. And this is where a mob descended on the hospital and murdered Matthew Williams. However, after doing investigation, additional investigation, and discovering the records that I'll discuss in a few minutes here, we recognized that and began to uncover something that is a little closer to the truth, in which we discovered that Matthew Williams had loaned his employer, Daniel Elliott's son, money during the Great Depression. And Matthew was going to go to the father after Daniel Jr. failed to pay his debts to Williams. And it's all laid out in the book, but it's really important part of the story, because all of this is alleged crimes. And I discovered contemporaneous as well as additional interviews from both white and blacks that refute this original story that Williams killed his employer. And so a lot of what I do is I employ forensic reconstruction to lay all of the evidence out that I discovered to get, again, closer to the truth, and to provide a formal investigation, even if it is on paper, for the descendants of Matthew Williams and his community.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about this process of forensic reconstruction that you went through, in terms of finding these documents that are closer to the truth and then laying out that process. What was that like?
Sure. And so to get there, we have to really begin to understand that, again, my main focus was to salvage the humanity of the victim. And it's very difficult to do that, specifically when you're trying to document the life and story of Black victims, and any Black people specifically in this context who are being victimized, just because of the nature of our, not only the sources, but also our institutions, in terms of our archival institutions. I'll get to archival institutions in 1 second, but one of the things that I show my students, specifically in regards to cases of racial terror lynchings, I show them the coverage predominantly in Black newspapers or the Black press, and I show them coverage in the white press. Almost all of the time, you'll see within the white press these historical characterizations that have, you know, in many ways not gone away, where the individual who is lynched or murdered is always defined by their alleged crime. We know nothing of their humanity, their family. And so in writing this book, I sought out to, as I mentioned, salvage that humanity by really trying to figure out the human story associated with these individuals. And thank goodness for the Black press, because of their coverage. That was one of the Black press served as the pillar and the foundation for the ways in which I employ this forensic reconstruction. I also received a great nudge, or I don't want to call it luck, but it was a blessing in many ways, to discover records that had been hidden in the state archives for 90 years that include records of eyewitnesses to this lynching, police records, police statements, as well as from both Black and white witnesses, as well as a daily journal from an undercover Pinkerton detective agent who actually infiltrates the mob. And so with these records, I was able to pull all of these different sources together and reconstruct the narrative associated with the lynching, but also the lynching's aftermath. And so literally going statement by statement and laying out the story is what I was able to do. However, the most difficult task was, again, focusing on centering the humanity of those involved. And I did that by using genealogical resources and tools to make sure that we had a full picture of the individuals, all of those involved in this case, and what they were bringing specifically to their interpretations of those events.
Wonderful. And so getting back to Matthew Williams' lynching, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the afterlife of the lynching. And, you know, take that however it is that you will. I know it becomes a political issue. Sort of what life does this sort of lynching take on after the fact?
So the lynching is really what I argue in my book. It served as this match that really lit the flames of needed to destroy, systemically destroy a Black community. At this point, you know, with everything we saw in terms of Tulsa, and I talk about this in the introduction of my book about the ways in which white supremacy evolves to survive. And we recognize at this period that the blatant massacre and racial terror that we saw in Tulsa was no longer acceptable to white society. And so there had to be some other way, I argue, through systemic means to dismantle and to destroy Black communities and in a way that was far more effective than these blatant acts of racial terror in terms of the long run. And so it was at that point that I discovered that the lynching of Matthew Williams was utilized, was the foundation and the beginning of a more strategic, sinister plan to dismantle and to destroy a Black business district in this region of the Maryland's Eastern Shore. This community was known as the Georgetown neighborhood, a Black business district, not on the same scale as Greenwood, but a Black business district nonetheless that found a way to survive and thrive during the Great Depression. This angered whites. They had their own bank. It was a very prominent community that Matthew Williams was a part of. It's no coincidence that the mob actually displayed his body at the entrance of Georgetown, putting all the Black people on notice in this community. And it's documented in the notes and the statements of the individuals who confessed to the lynching that Blacks in this region were getting out of line and they, you know, didn't know their place. And so right after that, if you track the records, I began to, most recently, we began discovering records from post-lynching, 1931 to 1932, where there are literally maps that we've discovered from real estate developers directly connected to members of the mob that are targeting, annotating all of the Black businesses and Black homes in this district and in this area. And so in 1931, there were around 19 Black businesses in this Georgetown community, in this district. To this day, there's only one building that remains, and that's the Charles Chipman Cultural Center, the formerly John Wesley United Methodist Church, of which Matthew Williams was a member. Even the bodies in the Black cemetery were exhumed to make way for highway expansion. This assault and lynching really is the first phase of what will become to be known as this guise of urban renewal that we see taking place throughout Black communities in this country. And it's also important to recognize as well that, you know, as much as people, we would like to think that Tulsa, that Greenwood was destroyed wholly in 1921, like most Black communities, Greenwood would rebuild, never to their original capacity or the original success, but they rebuilt nonetheless, rising from the ashes, only to be systemically targeted in the 50s and 60s through the same strategies and policies that we saw targeting Black communities throughout this country under the guise of urban renewal. And so that's what we see in this community. And we see a terror and continued silence amongst members of this community who I work with to this day regarding the lynching as well as the oppression that the Black community continues to face.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so Maryland's position as a border state seems to sort of complicate traditional perspectives on racial violence. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of the role of Maryland, where that sort of stands, and the way that we typically think about sort of traditional, for lack of a better term, sort of racial violence, and how that sort of manifests within your work.
Yes. So some call Maryland the unicorn. Some call Maryland the middle ground. I go with the middle ground. Barbara Jean Fields does a great job of characterizing this, Maryland's unique culture, specifically as it relates to black and white relations. I always point back to Maryland's large free black population that really provides a foundation for in some ways, a volatile, undercover volatile animosity between whites and blacks. And in a way, you did not have the same resources and you did not have the same systems in place or culture in place that you did in Mississippi that reinforced the racial hierarchy, right? Specifically, when you think about the free black population in Baltimore and in Maryland. And so oftentimes poor whites were forced to see and forced to work alongside or even be in contact with free blacks who had a certain level of success that their counterparts did not have in the Deep South. And so I think that has a lot to do with this, it provides a foundational, unique type of tension between blacks and whites that we see grow and grow and fester. And we see these correlations between the economic depravity, economic violence, and with the uptick in racial violence and racial terror that correlate with national economic downturns, but they also correlate as well in the state of Maryland. So when we look at 1890s, for example, the cases of racial terror lynching with the economic depression of that era, we move to 29 and onward with the Great Depression, you see this rise in animosity in these communities in the Upper South, specifically in Maryland, that you necessarily would not think would take place in this area. And so another important distinction as well is the region of the Eastern Shore. And so historically, it's important to understand that this specific region of the Eastern Shore, Salisbury, Maryland, was a part of this region called Delmarva. Delmarva during the, so it's literally on the peninsula. You have Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware on this peninsula. And during the Civil War, this specific area sought to secede from the Union and sided with the Confederacy. So you have this same type of spirit and culture. You know, Maryland may be Upper South and may be in close proximity to Washington, D.C., but you had a spirit of that was very similar to the Deep South, and some local historians argue and articulate that was present in Salisbury and in the Eastern Shore and in this region. Also, it was not until 1950 that the Bay Bridge, 50s and 60s, connected the Western Shore to the Eastern Shore. which was very important because in many ways this area of Maryland was cut off from the more populated and more progressive communities of Baltimore City. So there's a lot there in terms of Maryland, but I think from a historian's perspective, in terms of looking at the historiography, I was really concerned at this hyper-emphasis that I saw that sought to focus specifically on areas that and states that had these high numbers associated with racial terror lynchings in terms of documented cases. And it reminded me, as I talk about in the book, of what we saw with in the transatlantic slave trade in terms of the numbers game that Joseph E. Corey and Philip Curtin engage in, specifically around quantifying and counting Black bodies, in that there is a dehumanization that takes place, and we somehow equate the amount of cases to the, there's a hyperemphasis placed on the amount of cases versus the human story behind each incident. And so, and what Maryland tells you with these specific cases, that what was happening in Mississippi and in Alabama and in the Deep South was almost the exact same thing happening in terms of the form, structure, and cultures associated with racial terror lynchings and these spectacle lynchings that we saw 40 or so take place in the state of Maryland.
And this hyper-focus that you talk about in terms of focusing upon certain areas that have had this sort of racial terror and lynching happening versus other areas where this happened as well, such as in your book, why do you think that's so persistent still within sort of the historiography?
Well, I think it's so much easier to build on where the focus is. I think what I try to do with my students is to train them, as I articulate in my book, to be salvaging experts. And I also think, again, you have to think about the individual and human story. So yes, we have over 5,000 cases of documented racial terror lynchings in the U.S., but each one of those cases represents one individual, one story. And instead of focusing on the overall impact of the scope and scale of racial terror lynchings, we lose insight into the humanity of the victims and the psychological and physical damage that one incident brings to an individual's family as well as their community. And so I think it is just a part of, again, while I think it's similar to what we saw with the transatlantic slave trade, the Middle Passage research, I think it's just we are infatuated with numbers and being able to, quantify suffering based on the amount of documented cases, which I think is problematic. It's a lot easier as well because there's more research. And so for historians, oftentimes who want to get into a specific topic or a specific area, I spent 6 years documenting this one specific case. People ask me about other cases of lynchings in Maryland, and I'm very direct with them. My area, is 1931 to 33. I'm focusing on the lynching of Matthew Williams specifically and the related lynchings in this region. I don't purport to be an expert on racial terror lynching throughout the country or, throughout the region. And I think that's very important for historians to be honest about that, because if we're going to do the work, we have to be able to make sure that we're doing the work alongside and with the support of descendant communities, which are the communities that I center in my work. And so even before this book was completed, my main objective, once I discovered these records and this story, I sought out to identify any living collateral or linear descendants of Matthew Williams. And it literally was right around the time I began to close the book out that I finally was able to get in contact with a relative of Matthew Williams. And they have been helping and guiding this process and this work, the current work that we're doing to support this racial justice in this community. And so I think that's very important as well. But again, this is something that historians, we have to begin to recognize is necessary. We have to begin to move away from the traditions that have been laid out, you know, by the academy, and find a way to center the humanity and center racial justice in the work that we're doing.
And you do, as you were just saying, you get in contact with a descendant of Matthew Williams. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that process and how that's sort of incorporated into the work that you're doing.
Sure. As I mentioned, I tried to, I played a genealogist, as I would say, as much as I could. I did the best I could with Ancestry and these other resources, but I hit a wall at a certain point. And I was getting pretty good at it because, as I mentioned, for all of the individuals you'll see that I name in my book, for the most part, with maybe one or two exceptions, I did genealogical research on the individuals who gave testimonies, who gave statements, both black and white. I really sought out to utilize those same resources to identify Matthew Williams, but I hit a wall. And so I hired a professional master genealogist by the name of Demeter Green, who was able to take everything that I had pulled together, and she was able to locate the family of Matthew Williams and develop a pedigree as well within, I would say, a month and a half or so. She then pointed me to Miss Jeannie Jones, who I ended up calling it, I think, one of her aunt, who got the story a little wrong, and she thought that someone was actually lynched today. And so Miss Jones calls me in a frantic, you know, panic, saying, "What's going on? My aunt called and said someone's being lynched." And this is when I had to kind of reassure her that this was a relative, a long lost relative, that had been lynched. And from this day forward, Ms. Jones has been involved in the research work, the work of the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And we also have a film series that will be released very soon, a pilot we released on the anniversary of Matthew Williams' death that Ms. Jones was a part of as well.
All right, wonderful. And so I wonder, what do you want readers to take away after reading your book?
Sure. So I think one of the things I really want readers to take away, I want readers to understand that the lie that has been allowed to persist surrounding racial terror, lynchings, and racial violence can no longer continue to thrive and to live. This lie that lynchings took place at the hands of persons unknown. Black communities who I've worked with in this region hold within themselves stories and trauma that is not validated because records are not designed to validate their stories, and they're not kept in a manner that validates their stories in these cases. And so as a result, so much of this work is unknown, and so much of this story is unknown. And so that's very important for us to make sure that we're centering the lived experiences of those who have experienced this racial trauma and this racial terror, and we take their words and begin to do formal investigations and do real research to help document and salvage the humanity of these victims and the members of their community. One of the things that my book does, it highlights both black and white eyewitnesses to this crime. And one of the individuals that my book identifies is Mr. Maslin Pinkett. Maslin Pinkett is a professor at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And surprisingly, we discovered that Mr. Pinkett was also he's also the great-grandfather of Jada Pinkett Smith. And this has been verified by genealogists. And the reason why Mr. Pinkett is significant, because he speaks out directly in court, naming members of the mob and to the actual attorney general. And as we look at this attack or assault on truth telling in this post-Trump era, it is becoming a growing concern of mine as a historian that we are seeking to erase these stories of racial terror and racial violence. When we erase and try to move past these events or overlook them or erase, as I think is a better term, we overlook those who were on the right side of history as well. Those such as Mr. Pinkett, who spoke out and spoke out against justice, but also any others, any whites or others who may have spoken out on the right side and doing so. And so I hope that my work will inspire communities to embrace the truth associated with their past and embrace assessing the role in which their communities play in oppressing marginalized communities historically.
Yeah, I think that's definitely needed at this point in time. Well, Dr. Chavis, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I'll ask you just one final question. What are you working on now?
Well, so I just got back from Salisbury, Maryland, and so I'm working directly in the community. We're still filming for our project, but I'm working specifically as well to promote restorative justice efforts in the community. And as a result of the research from the book, the city of Salisbury has established a truth commission designed to investigate the racial terror and racial violence that's been targeted at the specific community. And so I'm advising and working with local activists and local leaders in the establishment of that committee. And I spend time with my students at George Mason University who are working to continue to support this community. So it's beyond the book. It's really about, again, as I mentioned, as a historian, taking what we do in the work and research and bringing it to life to promote racial justice and social transformation.
Absolutely. And two quick questions just off of that. Does the project that you're working on that's beyond this book, does that have a title?
Yes, Hidden in Full View is the title.
Wonderful.
Yes, Hidden in Full View.
Okay, perfect. And then secondly, I wonder, with the work that you're doing that's sort of outside just the scholarship portion of it, which I think is so pushed for academics and for sort of early career scholars as well, I wonder if you have any words of advice for people that are interested in taking their scholarship beyond just the page and sort of having it affect the real world.
Yeah, I think one of the things is that I've started to do as I have begun to really dive into the practice-based work and the activism-based work is to recognize that the things that come natural to us in terms of the ways in which we engage with communities based on the frames in which we have understood and studied, the theories in which we've studied and understood around anti-racism and classism, sexism, etc. As we begin to practice based on the our understanding of these theories, and we have to reflect on the practice work. And so for me, something as simple as beginning to journal daily and reflect on the experiences that I went through. I mean, what am I employing? How am I coming to the conversation? So really having to reflect, it's all easy for us to think about how we review and reflect and analyze, you know, theory, literature, and things like that. But in terms of our own actions and behaviors, taking a real-time account for the practice work and the activism that we're doing and doing that through reflective practice is very important. And I think it starts with as easily journaling and just working through and reflecting on the work that you are getting into. But you have to start somewhere. And as you make the transition from, you know, theory to practice or from, you know, theory to activism, then begin starting to reflect and take an account of the leap that you're taking.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Charles Chavis, the author of The Silent Shore, The Lynching of Matthew Williams, and The Politics of Racism in the Free State, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you take care.
Thank you so much, Amari.